It is a trustworthy statement worthy of full acceptance that the mind can only absorb what the behind can endure. So it's good to take a stretch break here. I had not met Matt Lapine until today, and I have decided that I don't like him. I don't like him because I'm going to look very inferior to him. That's the equivalent of going to a Yankees game and them starting off with Babe Ruth in the leadoff role, and everything that comes after that is going to be inferior. Okay, so my name is Nate Brooks. I am a professor at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. That's one of the Southern Baptist seminaries. We're in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And I'm really excited to be here and to talk about PTSD. If you have downloaded the conference notes, you'll notice that there is no handout for this. This is because I fell into the trap of taking on too many projects that all had the same due date. However, if you go to nateandkatebrooks.com, this is not promotional, I assure you, nateandkatebrooks.com, you're going to find a very under-construction website that is both my and my wife, who's also a counselor, our website. And if you click on Nate's writings, you'll see the handout to download there. We're not going to walk through all of those notes, but I figured that I would go ahead and give you more notes than I can cover, and you can look at those later. So it's nateandkatebrooks.com, no E in Brooks, and that's what the rest is spelled as you could expect. Go to Nate's writings, and then you'll see notes for this talk, and then also narcissistic personality disorder, which will be together tomorrow. Nate and Kate, NateandKateBrooks.com. NateandKateBrooks.com. Okay, so why am I the one talking about this? I teach all of the trauma and abuse classes at Southeastern from undergrad up through PhD level. I have my own private practice, Courage Christian Counseling, got a little booth out there, and we are a practice that focuses almost exclusively on providing trauma-informed and abuse-informed care to individuals virtually, individuals and couples. About 90% of the counseling that I do is involved with some form of abuse or some form of trauma. The number one group of people that I meet with professionally for counseling is abusive men, and the number two group of people that I meet with are individuals who have been abused by abusive men. So this world of trauma is the world that I swim in professionally. And because of that, I'm really grateful to be able to talk about this. I do want to say a couple things. First off, this is a topic that gets explicit fast, okay? And I know that in this gathering, there are some of you that are here more professionally and others that are here a little bit more personally. And so friends, we'll just agree on this together. If the things that we talk about here become too heavy for your heart to bear, please go ahead and just step out and take a break. We're not going to assume anything about anyone who steps out of the room, though, okay? Because some people may need a bathroom break and stuff like that. So that'll just be our pact together. You won't hurt my feelings. You won't hurt anybody else's feelings. If you start getting overwhelmed, grab a buddy, go outside, just take a break. There is nothing in here worth destabilizing yourself over for the sake of trying to care for someone else. Deal? Okay. All right. So I really appreciated what Matt shared earlier, and I'm taking the approach here that I want to start with using the DSM categories. The reason for that is that the DSM is a largely descriptive document. Okay, we have to start understanding that. In the introduction to the DSM, it says that the DSM makes no etiological claim or treatment claim of how to deal with the issues it describes. In other words, etiology talks about origins. The DSM is not interested in explaining why problems come to pass. It's also not that interested in describing how to treat said problems. That's the role of various theories of psychology. And in that, remember David Pallison described biblical counseling as a form of psychology, right? In that it's a way of engaging with the human soul. So the DSM itself isn't saying We're talking about why these things come to pass. We're simply describing symptoms that human beings experience. That's what Dr. Lapine was talking about when he says it's a way for us to expand our knowledge of human suffering, that it gives us some specific categories. Okay, so we're going to talk about PTSD specifically today. I think it's helpful to define some terms here. First off is the term trauma. Isn't it awesome when words go from being technical words to being thrown around by everything, right? Going to the DMV is a traumatic experience. No, it's not. You stood in line for 9 hours and you had an appointment, but that's not a traumatic event, right? Going to the Gap and them not having your size of jeans is not a trauma. Right? The great theologian Dash from the movie The Incredibles says, when everyone's special, nobody is. And that truth can be absorbed into the concept of trauma. When everything's trauma, nothing is. So we're trying to describe a unique human experience that can be differentiated from other human experiences. If I tell you that someone is struggling with an issue and they are washing their hands 20, 30 times in a setting to the point that they bleed, not because they believe that they're dirty, but because they have anxiety building up over the fact that they haven't washed enough. And so it's easier to do the ritual than it is to simply move on with life. What are we dealing with? Okay, yeah, everyone said OCD. How do you know that? Because that's the language that we've chose to attach to that particular trouble. No one in here said PTSD, right? Because we understand that that is a different sort of human troubles. That's a different bucket here. Let's go ahead and start by defining some terms. Okay, a traumatic event refers to the thing that has actually happened. It is an event that has happened to somebody. Traumatization refers to the impact that it has had on the person. Does that distinction make sense? So traumatic event is what happened. Rape, car accident, etc. The traumatization is the impact that it has had on a person. The dissociative experiences, insomnia, hypervigilance, hyperarousal. Those sorts of things. Does that distinction make sense there? Now, here's the tricky thing, is that trauma is usually a word that we use to describe both of them, okay? So when someone talks about their trauma, they're oftentimes referring both to the event that has happened to them and to their experience of that event. And I know I just mentioned rape here, friends. I want to say this. There are points that I am going to be more explicit than that. However, we're not going to do anything that's voyeuristic or unseemly there, okay? This is a conference where we're talking through the nitty-gritty details of counseling. We have to have beyond PG-rated conversations sometimes. However, there's a difference between that and a more professional setting versus a grotesque setting. I'm not going to hit the voyeuristic side of things. Okay. So you see in the notes there that there are a number of different types of events that are traumatic events. It can be abuse, it can be combat, an accident, a medical procedure gone awry, natural disasters. All of those are events that threaten the health and well-being of a person. And then traumatization is the potential result from those things. So I want to start by actually walking through the DSM's diagnostic criteria for trauma, as I think that will help give some shape to the conversation. All right. Now, there's a handful of criteria that are required for the diagnosis of PTSD. And the first one is pretty restrictive. The person has to be exposed to death, threatened death, actual or serious threatened injury, or actual or threatened serious sexual violence. Okay? Read those again. It's death or threatened death, actual or threatened serious injury, or actual or threatened sexual violence. You notice all of those are physically oriented and they are deeply terrifying that one is about to be physically mangled or harmed, right? This is a physical diagnosis in terms of the qualifying events. Now, there's various ways that that one can experience that. One is through direct exposure. In other words, it happens to you. It can be witnessing it. So, for example, just think through even some things that were in the headlines. And again, this is not politics. We're doing counseling here, right? What happened in Israel with the number of concert goers that had to sit in bushes and watch women be raped on the field, knowing that if they rush out to try and protect the women, they die, right? That's exposure to a traumatic event that can lead to a diagnosis of PTSD. Learning that a relative or a close friend was exposed to a trauma, or indirect exposure in the course of professional duties. This is first responders, medical professionals, and counselors. Right, so that's the first criteria that's required for a diagnosis of PTSD. It has to be physical in nature, and it has to be a significant threat to one's health and well-being. Now, there are a number of other criteria that are required as well, and they fall in different categories. I'm not going to read all of them because you can go, if you want to cure your insomnia, read the DSM. But we'll hit some highlights here. Criterion B is that the traumatic event has to be persistently re-experienced. In other words, the person has to be reliving the event over and over and over again in some way, shape, or form. It could be unwanted, upsetting memories, right? There's a memory there that consistently replays and loop in their mind, and they can't get it out. Nightmares, flashbacks, or traumatic triggers. I've been working with a client. I'll go ahead and skip some details here for the sake of their privacy, but they had a severe traumatic event that happened to them, and then they had to go to the hospital over it. One of their children got sick, took the child to the hospital, and the same doctor that saw them with a traumatic event also saw the child. It's a traumatic trigger that led to the experience of flashbacks and severe emotional distress due to a reminiscence of a really, really terrible day. Does that make sense? There's this consistent pattern of re-experiencing. So that's the second criteria, is re-experiencing. The third criteria is avoidance. Avoidance. What this simply means is that you alter your behavior so that you're not triggered by things around you. Right. So say you have an individual who is who was groomed and sexually abused by a pastor in counseling. That individual, after that, avoids going to church. Why? Because what's it like for them when a pastor walks up on stage and opens the Bible and says, "Thus says the Lord"? They're remembering that pastor that sexually took advantage of them using the exact same words. Right. So you now have behaviors. You have the avoidance of something that they used to do in order to avoid the experience of distressing memories and upsetting emotions and such inside of them. So that's criteria three, is that category of avoidance. Criteria four is negative thoughts or feelings that began or worsened after the trauma. So there becomes this pervasive sense of negative feelings that begin or get worse because of the traumatic event. So this could be a variety of different things. It could be an exaggerated blame of self or of others for causing the traumatic event. If only I had left 5 minutes earlier. If only it is my fault that I said yes to go on that date with that guy. If it is my fault that my child was hit by that car because I should have been paying closer attention. Some of those are natural thoughts, but when it becomes pervasive, and there is the negative affect, the negative feeling takes over the person's kind of emotional schema. That's when we're in all of a sudden qualifying for this, right? The next criteria is arousal related. Arousal and reactivity, and clearly we don't mean sexual arousal here, we're talking about emotional arousal. So what this may look like is irritability or aggression. Right? All of a sudden you have someone who just kind of bites everybody's head off, or risky or destructive behavior. You often see this in women who have suffered sexual assault. There can be a corresponding increase in just risky sexualized behaviors. But you can also see the exact opposite, where there's whether someone begins binge eating or dressing in various ways to attempt to make themselves an unattractive target in their minds can be a situation as well. Difficulty concentrating, difficulty sleeping. So those are the primary criteria for a diagnosis of PTSD. Symptoms also have to last for more than a month, and symptoms create distress or functional impairment. In other words, this has to be negatively affecting someone's life in some way. I can't go to work. I can't parent the way that I used to. I can't focus. I can't sleep. Right? There's an impairment that occurs. And then lastly, it can't be due to drug abuse or taking medications. Right? So that's the criteria for PTSD. What I find is that people are oftentimes surprised at how restrictive that definition of PTSD is. Because remember, this has to be related to an event that threatened someone physically. Now, a couple things that you may notice that don't make the list then is things like emotional abuse. We'll talk about that more in just a second. Okay. Now, the World Health Organization has done a study on PTSD that looked at the traumatic experiences of 68,000 people worldwide in 24 countries. Now, those numbers may not hit you, they may hit you strongly. Most psychological research, like a study of a couple thousand people, is massive. This is 68,000 people across 24 countries, and these 24 countries range from the highest socioeconomic brackets to the lowest socioeconomic brackets, right? So this is an attempt to stare at humanity and ask the question, how does humanity tend to respond when it comes to these PTSD qualifying events? 70.4% of individuals who responded to the survey, or that were surveyed, had experienced at least one traumatic event. 70.4 individuals. The average number of exposures was 3.2 traumas per person. You know, when the book of Genesis predicts that we are going to have trouble, that's a promise that has come to horrible fulfillment, hasn't it? We shouldn't be shocked that this is the case when we understand that all creation is cursed and groans waiting for release, and that we are human beings who are described as inventors of evil within the Bible. We live in a world in which human beings do horrific things to each other, and we live in an environment that is not our friend anymore and does terrible things to us. Now, PTSD symptoms occur with different rates based off of different qualifying events, okay? There are certain traumatic events that create a higher percentage likelihood that someone will eventually develop PTSD than others. When I take surveys in my class of what do you think is the event that is most likely to produce PTSD, I usually get the same answer, and it's combat experience. That makes a lot of sense, as you are in a life or death situation where oftentimes it is kill or be killed. Interestingly enough, combat trauma was one of the lowest ranking qualifiers for PTSD. Only 3.6% of individuals who have experienced combat are going to develop PTSD. Only 3.6%, so roughly 4 out of every 100 individuals. The number one experience that is most likely to produce PTSD is actually rape. Rape is the number one experience. 19% of individuals who are raped will develop PTSD. So think of your church for a minute. I go to a church of about 2,000 people. For some of you, that may seem huge. Some of you, that might seem microscopic. About 50, so that means that about 50% of individuals in my church are female. We also know that one out of every four women in the United States is going to suffer rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. That means that every Sunday morning we have 250 women who have a qualifying event for PTSD in my congregation. And then about 20% of them will develop PTSD. That means that on any given Sunday, we have about 40 women who are working through PTSD or will work through PTSD due specifically to a rape or attempted rape. You know, I think a lot of times in our cultural imagination, when we think of PTSD, the person who pops to mind is a combat veteran. In fact, the person that should pop to mind is a woman who suffered domestic violence. Now, that does not diminish the reality of the challenges that our veterans have to work through. Please don't hear that at all. In no way, shape, or form am I diminishing those who have given their lives to serve us in that way. Rather, what I think it's important to do is elevate the suffering of other forms to elevate other forms of suffering to match perhaps the honor that we might even give our military veterans, right? The other top PTSD-producing qualifying events are physical abuse by a romantic partner. So domestic violence. Third at 11% is kidnapping, which again is a very intimate experience in that it's a person in front of you who is doing this to you and you're absolutely powerless to stop it. And then the last would be non-rape sexual assault. So that would be non-penetrative sexual assault that happens there, right? If you notice, all four of those have significant powerlessness, and also it's a very one-on-one kind of situation. The stronger the relational connection, and the more the less agency the individual has, the higher chance there is of someone developing PTSD, versus something like a combat trauma, where in at least modern warfare, it is a little bit less face-to-face, and there's more agency in the sense of, I can do something about this. It is kill or be killed. Does that make sense there, friends? Okay. All right. Out of all the years that human beings have spent experiencing PTSD, about 42% of those are due to intimate partner violence. So, intimate partner violence is the number one reason for PTSD. All right. Now, this is what the World Health Organization concluded. They said, trauma exposure is common throughout the world, unequally distributed, and differential across trauma types with respect to PTSD risk. Although a substantial minority of PTSD cases remit within months of onset, mean symptom duration is considerably longer than previously recognized. Okay, so in other words, there are places in the world that have much higher incidences of PTSD than others. One of the more interesting experiences that I had in life was I was actually in Ukraine the day that President Zelensky was elected. I was teaching at Kyiv Theological Seminary there in Kyiv, and this was about a year before the war escalated, before Russia did the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. A number of my students are in the Ukrainian military. I don't know if all of them are still alive. The chances of that is actually pretty small. But in Ukraine, you have a country where 95% of the population has experienced a qualifying event. And the 5% that don't are those that are too little to understand or whose minds have been eaten away with dementia and don't understand what's going on, right? So you have actually there an entire population that the whole country has experienced this. Contrast that with certain zip codes in the United States where crime is incredibly low and the affluence is quite high, individuals in those higher socioeconomic brackets are far less likely to have a qualifying event happen to them. right? So even though 3.2 incidences is the mean average that human beings experience traumatic events, you have things like Ukraine where sirens go off every night and it's get to the shelter or you might not make it through the night, right? So we need to understand that's what it means when it's saying it's unequally distributed amongst humanity. At the same time, the World Health Organization did note that the symptoms of this last long time, usually. Sometimes it resolves on its own, but most of the time it doesn't. Okay, now I want to think for a second about something Dr. Lapine said. So moving away from the percentages and such, let's talk a little bit about human experience here for a moment. Do you remember how he talked about the categorical model? That a critique of the DSM is that you have the thing or you don't have the thing. You do have PTSD or you don't have PTSD. Let's think back through that criteria for a moment. About 4 years ago, I was doing about 55 miles an hour on a rural South Carolina highway in my 2007 Pontiac Vibe. If you're unfamiliar with that model, think about a can of peas and put wheels on it. It's the kind of car that grad students buy because they have no money whatsoever. That's the kind of vehicle it was. It was a holdover from my seminary days. So I'm doing about 55 miles an hour down this highway, and out of the corner of my eye, I see a deer emerge out of the brush. Okay, it was November. Was it November? I think so. It was the season that all the boy deer were going just a little bit nuts. So we're cruising along, and we called them yard rats in South Carolina because there were so many deer everywhere, right? So this thing pops out, and I see it out of the corner of my eye, and I brake slightly in order to let the deer pass in front of me. Stupid deer doesn't do that. Course corrects, and I see it go three-step, two-step, one-step, and its chest hits the driver's side window right next to my face. Okay, the antlers wrapped around the front and hit my window, and had that windshield not held, I don't want to think about what would have happened. Later, I could actually put my pinky through my window with no effort whatsoever. So I really praise God that it didn't happen. I spent the next few weeks picking glass out of my face and had to go get some plastic removed out of my eye and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, I've got a tiny scar on my chin and that's it. I was very thankful for that. But as I'm driving there, I'm watching this deer come to me and I see it. And the last thought that flashed through my mind before that deer hit was, people get killed by deer. I bet this is how. And then the world just exploded in glass, right? And the first thought was I opened both my eyes and I did this to make sure that they were both working. And I looked in my rearview mirror and my face was covered in blood. It was mine, not the deer's. And I just was kind of in shock at that point. That is a qualifying event because there's the threatened death or the expectation of severe bodily harm. That's a qualifying event. Now, it is a relatively minor qualifying event in terms of the world of possible qualifying events, but that qualified me for a potential PTSD diagnosis. And there are other of those symptoms that I experienced. One was hypervigilance. Okay, I lived about an hour from where I worked at the time, and a lot of it was spent driving through kind of rural, windy South Carolina roads. And at the end of every time I drove home from work, I would have to go get a heating pad to put on my shoulders because I would involuntarily clench my shoulder blades as I was driving out of concern over the fact that I might hit another deer. Now, I'm a relatively logical person, I think. You ask my wife, you might get a different answer, but I think so. And I'm sitting there telling myself the chances of hitting another deer are almost zero. This is silly, Nate. Why are you doing this? And yet telling myself that didn't cause it to stop. Right? And so for a couple months, every time I come home from work, my shoulders would they would hurt to the point they felt bruised from how tight my muscles would clench. You know what? That's 4 years ago. And while that symptom has faded, I still experience a degree of hypervigilance driving on roads that are rural where I know deer exist. And I have aggressively braked our family van more than once over mailboxes that looked a whole lot like deer. Why on earth do we design those things to look like animals that can hurt you? I don't know why, right? There were other symptoms that, that certainly were there as well. But here's the thing. I didn't qualify for PTSD, and yet I had symptoms of traumatization. Does that make sense? So think about it. You have a female sexual assault survivor. She can't sleep. She, standing in the line at McDonald's, a man taps her on her shoulders, and she jumps out of her skin. She goes into an elevator, and a man steps in there, and her heart is all of a sudden beating 1,000 miles a minute, breaks out in a cold sweat while telling herself, nothing's going to happen here. She can't turn that off, though, right? But if she's not avoiding situations, she doesn't qualify for PTSD. How good is her life quality? It's low, right? So what Dr. Lapine brought up in that category of the categorical model, we need to understand actually as counselors, what matters less is a formal diagnosis of PTSD, but rather what someone's experience of traumatization is. Okay, the formal diagnosis of PTSD is very helpful in terms of its ability to help people acquire care and services. However, as we sit with people, the largest question we want to ask isn't, does this person have PTSD? The question we want to ask is, what is this person's day-to-day experiences and the symptoms that they are experiencing that then we can care for those? The formal diagnosis matters far less than actually caring about what their life is like. Because the truth of the matter is, you can be living an incredibly difficult existence and yet not qualify for having PTSD due to the fact that you don't meet one of the criteria. Does that make sense, friends? Tracking with that there? Okay. Now, this leads to language that you may see in some places called big T trauma and little T trauma. Has anyone heard that language before? Yeah, about a third of the people in here. Okay. So big T trauma, that's like capital T, big T. That refers to those formal traumatic events, the body-oriented traumatic events. Little T trauma refers to the kinds of events that befall human beings that are not physical in nature, but can create symptoms of traumatization. Because this is another complication that we have. 60% of people who would qualify for PTSD do not qualify for PTSD because their qualifying event was emotional and not physical. Okay? So I'll say that again, just so we're clear. When you take all those criteria of the of reimagining, avoidance, negative affect, hyperarousal, someone who qualifies for all of those criteria, but the activating event wasn't threatened death, it was severe emotional distress, they don't qualify for PTSD because it wasn't physical. However, they met all the other criteria. 60% of individuals who would qualify for PTSD don't because their activating event was not physical. There's been studies done, actually, of women in domestic violence marriages who have experienced both physical violence and emotional abuse from their husbands. 70% of those women would say that the emotional abuse is worse than the physical abuse. Because the physical abuse is at least over and done with, the emotional abuse is perpetually tormenting. And so actually, when we look at the category of PTSD, when you have individuals who've experienced both emotional severe emotional suffering and severe physical suffering, they tend to prioritize the emotional abuse as being worse, but the diagnostic criteria tends to insinuate that physical harm is worse. So that's a little bit backwards from what's there. Now again, this does not mean that we throw out the DSM category. It's incredibly helpful to identify, hey, when people have these types of events happen to them, then that means that we can expect these types of symptoms to possibly develop. That's really helpful for us. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. What's the use of the DSM category? Why don't we simply say, chuck it and just use what the Bible says? Because this gives us a language of specificity with which we as counselors can actually come and say, huh, this person has these symptoms. That's a natural response to an unnatural event. At least when it comes to PTSD, that's why this is helpful. As counselors, though, we want to be wiser than the DSM and recognizing that we care for humans, not diagnostic codes. And so that question of even if someone doesn't qualify for PTSD because their experience is due to an emotional upheaval, that doesn't matter for our care for them. Because the question isn't diagnosability, the question is what their human experience is. The way that I like to think about big T versus little t trauma, again, big T trauma refers to people whose clinical qualifications do qualify for PTSD. Little t trauma, so lowercase t, is those who don't qualify but whose lives are still incredibly difficult, is thinking about two different fatal experiences. What's your name, brother? Andrew, I'm sorry, you're about to die a couple different ways here, Andrew. All right, Andrew, imagine you step out of here and cross the street and don't look both ways, and you get hit by one of these big old DFW buses. Okay, are you dead, Andrew? Very much so. It was an instant event that splattered you on the ground. That's one way to die. Now, imagine that you discover that instead of this, that this coffee cup was actually laced with radioactive substances, and you have ingested a really high dose. Are you going to die? Yes, you will. You're going to die slowly, though. And actually, you're not going to notice anything is wrong until you're very sick quite a while later. Big T trauma is the bus. Little t trauma is the radioactive material, right? So with big T trauma, you can come back to life now. Thank you. Big T trauma is that kind of event that we stare at and say, oh my gosh, that's a big deal. Little t trauma are those events that are smaller, that are more emotional, et cetera, that oftentimes have the slow accretion like a stalagmite or a stalactite where they build over time to the point that someone says, something is really wrong with me, but I can't figure out what, until you begin realizing that it's then the slow radioactive poisoning over time. Are we tracking with that there? Okay. All right. Now, next question is, why do some people experience the symptoms of traumatization and others don't? Right? Are there human beings who suffer significant distress due to a natural disaster and they're fine, and their neighbor who experiences the exact same thing goes to pieces? I don't mean goes to pieces in terms of going crazy. I mean in terms of the symptoms. Yeah, absolutely, right? You can have two people in the same car accident who have the same non-injuries, and they have wildly different experiences in terms of what it does to them. At the end of the day, we don't know. No one can fully explain why some people develop traumatization and other people don't. Sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, that happened to you? That person's gonna need counseling. That's not always the case. Sometimes people are incredibly resilient in surprising ways. Other times people have significant distress in ways that are a little bit surprising. So that shouldn't surprise us, because the Bible does teach us that even though we might write poetry that says we are masters of our fate and we are captains of our own souls, that's just not the case, is it? How much of you are you actually in control of? Not a lot, right? We don't understand exactly why things hit us the way that we do, or the way that they do. But there are factors that have been identified as increasing or decreasing the likelihood that someone will experience traumatization. The first thing is the belief system that a person holds before the traumatic event happens. All right, what's your name, brother? Jordan. All right, Jordan, if you believe that human beings are naturally good and kind, and then you get mugged at gunpoint, what does that do to your worldview? It challenges your worldview, doesn't it? Because not only did you just experience perhaps getting pistol whipped, you have also had the way in which you interpret human beings around you has now been deconstructed, and that's causing some significant chafing inside your soul as your worldview no longer holds water. You might try and say, well, it was just a bad egg, but now all of a sudden you have to explain why there was the bad egg that was there. Versus if you're a Christian and you say human beings are flawed and broken. All human beings are made in God's image and display some elements of his glory, but we're damaged. And even the best of us still sin. And the worst of us sin badly. Terrible things have happened to you, but it didn't deconstruct your worldview too. And so the more one's worldview going into an event can explain the traumatic event, the less likely that someone will develop PTSD. Another factor, and this one's actually been demonstrated to be the most important in preventing PTSD, is the strength of someone's support system. Okay, so imagine you have a family, there's a 12-year-old girl in the family, and it's mom, dad, daughter. That's the whole family. And then dad goes to prison for 30 years for dealing drugs. White-collar crime. Mom has an incredibly strong family that she goes and lives with daughter. And grandpa takes over and becomes the functional dad to that little girl. And the little girl goes to a school in which there are teachers that actively believe in her and invest in her. And that little girl goes to some counseling and is able to receive good care that helps her process through the fact that dad wasn't who I thought he was. Right? And there's a whole network of cousins around that become playmates and just help little 12-year-old girl go back to normal. That's one scenario. Imagine, though, another scenario in which the same thing happens, but there's no family network. I should have mentioned the church over there, too. Family, church, etc. You have someone where there's no financial, or there's no family to help care. And mom maybe has a GED, and her prospects for work are bleak. That person's going to wind up in Section 8 housing, which is typically in the rougher parts of town. And what kind of schools typically are surrounded by Section 8 housing? It's the kind of schools that get the 2s and the 3s on the out of 10 reports that parents check when they move to locations. And mom may have to work 2 or 3 jobs in order to put food on the table. So then who's actually raising little girl? It's typically the peers, who are also from families in which the same dynamic is at play. That little girl is far more likely to develop symptoms of traumatization than the little girl who has that strong family system that folds her into itself when she suffers, as opposed to, say, you're on your own. Okay? The support system that one has a significant impact on the way that on the likelihood that traumatization will occur. There's other things, though. The intensity of the traumatic stress. Okay, my deer event was relatively low in intensity. That's incredible. Some of you serve in missions contexts, right? That is incredibly different than a woman who is gang raped in India, right? That's or a woman who is held as a sex slave in Rwanda. That's high intensity. But there's also the issue of duration, where you may have take Ukraine again. This is low intensity, believe it or not, in that there's a low likelihood that someone will actually be killed by a missile in any given night. But the duration is significant. We're thinking of essentially an XY graph in which we're mapping the area that's there, right? So you can have something that's incredibly long in duration. So that woman who is gang raped in India, if she is held as a sex slave in which that is her daily existence, the chances of her developing PTSD are far higher than the woman who is gang raped once. Are we tracking with that, friends? Okay. Also, the relationship between the perpetrator and the victim. The closer the relationship, the more likely someone's going to develop PTSD. Or I should say symptoms of traumatization, not simply just PTSD. The closer the relationship, because when a little girl is sexually abused by her dad, who is supposed to protect her, who little girls are hardwired to love, right? Like, I'm going to go home, and my four-year-old little girl is going to sprint out to me and tell me all about all of her adventures with her unicorns, stuffed, not real. Just to be clear, right, that happened there. Like, I didn't have to teach her to do that. It's ingrained in her. When dad is a predator, that's far more shaking than when someone who is unknown is a predator, right? So the strength of relationship between the two, the tighter it is, the worse it is. There's also cultural factors. I was in a seminary class once and was taking, it was a seminary that was located right in the middle between a urban black community and a suburban white community. And I was taking a class on racial reconciliation. And one of the 45-year-old black women maybe 50-year-old black woman in the class said, 3 weeks ago, my son was shot and killed in a drive-by shooting. It was an incredibly shaking moment. But it was fascinating to watch the difference in response between the white students, including myself, and the black students. The white student response was, oh my gosh, what? And there was another older black woman in the class who looked at the woman and said, oh no, honey, not you too. Right there you have a community that is used to working through that particular type of tragedy versus a community that is not used to working through that tragedy. And again, we're talking as counselors here. We cannot get into the issue of why this is the case, and I'm not making a comment about white versus black, how that is, right? Crime follows poverty. Crime does not follow ethnicity. There's a whole host of reasons why certain black communities tend to be more impoverished than others. So just let's focus on that as counselors, right? But that right there demonstrates, actually, it would be far more shaking for a white woman in the same situation because she's not going to have the same cultural support than that woman. Right? She is the only person she would know who has dealt with this versus the community that's able to fold her in and say, we deal with this as a community. Again, that's not making light of any type of suffering, but we're talking about the likelihood of traumatization. And then also the person's personality. Some of us tend to be more resilient than others, and that's some combination of genetics and upbringing and just who we are. So those factors really are significant when it comes to why individuals experience traumatization. All right. Now here's the deal, friends. I have like three more pages of notes, four more on this, and a couple things that I'll talk through in those notes, which you can read, are a fascinating thing is that secular individuals describe trauma as a moral injury or a heart wound. And I hope that just made you really happy. Because as biblical counselors, what are we all about? The heart and morals. And it's fascinating to me that when we look at trauma, Diane Langberg has said trauma is the missions field of the 21st century. And if we have secular individuals who are staring at this and saying, the traumatization is a moral injury, it's someone's conscience, someone's sense of reality has been deeply scarred and hurt and wounded, we look at that and say, yes, it has, because we long for Eden. And trauma is a violation of what we were designed for. You were not designed, human beings were not designed to be sexually assaulted. And so when we are, it's natural for there to be extreme responses. Human beings were not designed to have their homes wiped out by Hurricane Katrina. And so when that causes significant difficulty inside of people's lives, they're not weird, they're normal, because they were built for Eden, not east of Eden. The fact that the secular world is willing to talk about this in terms of moral injury and heart wounds, that actually plays right into our ability to speak gospel truth and its implications into people's lives. Okay, now I am not going to talk at length about that for one particular reason, and that's that I trust you guys. You're Christians. You sit in churches that teach how God meets us in our sufferings. The important thing that we need to remember is that trauma counseling is a little bit different than most counseling because it involves the collision of body, soul, and spirit, and it takes a long time. Okay? It takes a long time. 2 days ago, I taught on this at Southeastern, and I said, I have a live video of trauma counseling. And the students were excited, and I put up there on the screen a picture of a snail. And we sat and watched it slowly but surely inch its way across the entirety of the screen, and they were very disappointed. But that was the point, right? In a lot of counseling situations, we go from point A to point B to point C to point F, and that's how it goes. But when you're dealing with issues where there's deep injustice, we don't simply say, yes, that was wrong, God hates it too, and then move on. I want you to do something for a second. Hold in your head something that someone said to you that was particularly cutting at least 15 years ago. Y'all got something. Something terrible that happened to you or something that someone said that was cutting to you 15 years ago or more. I got something in my head. You have something in yours probably. What the heck is wrong with you that you still remember that? Right? Nothing at all. Right? Nothing at all. Why? Because, and how many times have you said, I'm going to just forget about it. I'm not going to go ahead and live in light of that anymore. It doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because your heart was injured and you experienced a moral wound. And just in the same way that physical wounds can take a long time to heal and they leave scar tissue, so too does traumatization. There's more info in further notes here, but I do want to leave a handful of minutes here for questions, friends. My goal here has not been to provide a thoroughgoing approach to trauma counseling. We have another track that does that. Come back and do that one next year. My goal in this one is to particularly unpack the diagnostic criteria and to recognize this is what trauma is, this isn't what trauma is, and how trauma is being spoken of in secular world, which we tend to be a little bit weaker as biblical counselors oftentimes in understanding what's going on in secular psychology. It's being talked about in categories that play right into our hands as biblical counselors. We just have to be very careful to be slow and patient and listen and not assume that symptoms of traumatization are sinful anxiety and such, but rather it's normal, natural, creaturely fear. All right, thanks, friends. We have a few minutes for questions. Are there questions? We have a friend right here.
Okay, so here's a can of worms. What about the generational effects? And I'm thinking both of normal generational effects for traumatized parents, but also I've read some things in the past about like Holocaust survivors.
Yeah, that's a great question about generational effects. We have a phrase that captures this fairly well in the English language, and that's hurt people, right? So the generational effects oftentimes are the fact that you have an individual who is significantly damaged or by trauma. In other words, they experience traumatization. And then that can lead to significant like relational, emotional disturbances and things of that nature. So say you have someone who is just deals with hyperarousal and a difficulty in terms of regulating their emotions. Well, what's that going to look like when they're a parent? And then what's that little boy, little girl's experience of a parent who has a really hard time regulating their emotions? And then how is little boy, little girl trained to deal with emotions? I mean, I read books to my kids in the same tone of voice that my dad read them to me. My wife pointed that out one day. I didn't try to do that. It just happened. Right? We tend to replicate what we've grown up with. So that's, in a large part, what we're looking at when it's the generational transmission there, which is different than the crepelinianism that we looked at last time, where it was genetic. And therefore, we had to, the Nazis purged the Jews to get rid of inferior genes. We're not saying that that's genetic. We're saying that that's actually largely due to upbringing. And if you're comfortable with the term attachment theory, that is something that we would look at there too, right? Where perhaps anxious attachment produces anxious attachment. I have a friend who's doing a PhD dissertation on how attachment disorders, what is that like in biblical language? I'm excited to read it because that really is a concept of relationality, which we should expect to significantly influence us because we are largely relational beings. There we go. That was way more than you asked, but I'm a professor and I talk for a living, so it's super dangerous to ask me questions. All right, other questions there, friends?
Just to kind of speak to that, I had an interesting situation where I was trying to lovingly understand a relational issue, and it didn't really come out till I got some family history on somebody that wasn't even in the room. It was a grandparent who, as a kid, pushed a sibling into the street, and the kid got hit by a car. And because of that, that grandparent was afraid of getting too close to people, so didn't get close to his own child. And that child was the parent of my client, who wanted to be close because he missed out on that from his own dad. But my client was like, "You're too close. Get away. So it was interesting to find, like, wow, something that happened decades ago in a family's history can really add to the landscape of trauma and how it can affect different relationships.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're there to care for that person, Jeff. My favorite theologian is a guy named Herman Bavinck. He's an old Dutch guy who is now deceased. But he said in one of his writings a line that changed my counseling life. He said, "A person's philosophy is often nothing more than the history of their heart." A person's philosophy is often, so how they view the world and act, is often nothing more than the history of their heart, which includes the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? Let's be really clear about that. But what you have there is a person's, the history of their heart, right? I am scared to get close to people because I damage people. Gets pushed from one generation to another until that cycle is intentionally broken. Yeah, I'm so glad you're there to care for him, and thanks for sharing that story, Jeff. All right, other questions? I think we had another question there, friend.
So I had a question about this, and maybe you don't want to go into this, but the moral injury and the heart wounds, because that can be pretty pervasive. Like, husbands hurt wives all the time, wives hurt husbands all the time, parents hurt children all the time. Almost anything could fit in those two categories, but is it trauma? And then if it is trauma, that response of the person once they think or know they've been traumatized feels exponentially worse. So now they have a harder time forgiving the person because you traumatized me. So how do you balance that definition? Does that make sense?
It does. And I've got like 60 seconds to answer it. Okay. I can only speak really generally to that at this point. What's the number one thing that we need as counselors? We need wisdom. It's the number one thing we need. And so are there situations in which people overly, that they respond in such a way that is significantly over the top to what has happened to them? Right? Like, you have a newly married couple and the husband raises his voice in an argument, and it's abuse worthy of divorce. Whoa, let's pump the brakes on that. But if we're honest, remember, a person's philosophy is often nothing more than the history of the heart. Where did that idea come from? That's probably been picked up historically from something, right? What they're reading, what friends are. What I would say is, again, just a mild critique of our discipline's history. Biblical counseling has tended to be rather unfocused on people's historical narratives and more focused on obey this Bible passage. And I would simply say that we want a nuanced understanding of people, understand that who they are has been largely shaped by the things they've experienced, and they may not realize that it wasn't normal. So with an individual who tends to be hypersensitive, I find that in my counseling practice, oftentimes we need to go back and understand why that is the case, because that tends to be something that the dial is turned up too loud on, right? And we may need to work to dial it down. But also, again, just say it's a husband and a wife, living with your wife in an understanding way means also understanding your spouse's buttons that get pushed that seem too loud. Like, I know the things with my wife that if I do this, that will lead to that leads to more personal disintegration than maybe if I was married to somebody else because of some things from my wife's past, and she knows the same for me, right? So I think in those types of situations, we want to turn a compassionate eye on it rather than a what's wrong with you eye. But then as we also want to lead people to understand, hey, your responses aren't automatically good and do need to be tested according to common grace wisdom of how humans tend to respond, and also God's word that is going to include things like repentance, forgiveness, etc., etc. That's as nuanced as I can be, and I've already taken 2 more minutes of your time than you paid to be here for. So, deep apologies. Thanks for this, friends. It's been wonderful.